The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to longtime film critic Kirk Honeycutt. For many years, he was the chief film critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Today, he's the author of John Hughes, A Life in Film, an illustrated tribute to the man behind Ferris Bueller's Day Off, National Lampoon's Vacation, The Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, Alone, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Stick around, because how often do I have an excuse to say, Bueller? Bueller? Without annoying my kid. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of teen actors who now realize they missed the golden age of adolescent mischief by at least 30 years in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Ferris Bueller's Day Off is easily one of my favorite movies of all time. I was already a college graduate by the time it appeared in the mid-1980s, but so what? It was the movie that spoke to my inner narrator like no other. I didn't necessarily want to be Ferris. I just wanted a day off like his. And who wouldn't? Now, every time that I see Ferris as I'm channel surfing, I'll stop and watch it. Ferris talking to the audience, Ferris singing Twist and Shout in a parade, Ferris fighting with his sister, and, of course, Ferris telling us at the end, "Go home. The movie's over." Now, there are other John Hughes films of which I'm a fan, of course, including National Lampoon's Vacation, Christmas Vacation, and Weird Science. Home Alone deserves an honorable mention in my list as well. Now, less so for me are the more standard fare, such as Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink. I think I was just too old for teen angst when they came around, and it just really hasn't drawn me back in to go watch again. Now, former Hollywood Reporter chief film critic Kirk Honeycutt has just published a book, John Hughes, A Life in Film, that is a rich, illustrated guide to these films and many more, including Uncle Buck, 16 Candles, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Honeycutt is also the man behind HoneycuttsHollywood.com, his own film review site. Kirk Honeycutt, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you.
So, Kirk, I mean, good to have you, fun book, blah, 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 blah. How could you possibly dislike National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation?
I just didn't find it that funny. I think the first National Lampoon film, Vacation, was actually the best John Hughes film that he didn't direct himself. It really, Harold Ramis, who passed on just around the time I was writing the book, and I put in a call to him, and I didn't get a hold of him, and next thing I knew, we lost him. But he did a wonderful job. He was a really good director, you know, Groundhog Day, all these great films. But this was a superbly directed film, and I think is the first well-written John Hughes film. He had had a couple of other credits, or he tried to make a couple other films, which I detail in the book. But this was the first one that said, hey, this guy can write. But back to Christmas Vacation, it didn't seem like there was any storyline, and I didn't feel that the peripheral characters, played by all these amazing character actors, were really well used. So it was just Chevy Chase and one pratfall after another, and it didn't have that narrative drive that the first film did. And I think all the other vacation movies have lacked that. And by the way, they're going to do another one now. So you have another one's heading your way.
Well, I never cared for European Vacation, but Christmas Vacation, I mean, it's I talked in the introduction about Ferris Bueller, which I just adore that movie. And Christmas Vacation, in my family at least, I mean, it's we got to watch it at least once or twice a year. And when I hear squirrel, I don't even have to name the movie around my wife. I just say squirrel, and we just start dying laughing. I don't know. I was thinking about maybe we would put the interview on hold and I'd send you back to watch the film again and then come back to discuss it just in case you catch something, but we'll let it go. Now, the other thing is I never actually considered myself a big John Hughes fan, because in my head I think of Pretty in Pink and Breakfast Club, 16 mm-hmm. Candles, but I like many of his films. So I wondered if you would explain for folks, I guess myself included, what is it that makes his group of films stand out? What makes them a whole?
Well, it depends on the kind of films you're talking about, because the first half of his career, up until I would say She's Having a Baby, he was doing films about young people, and they were pretty autobiographical. They were films that talked directly to teenagers as if they were the adults, and the adults were this other strange species on planet Earth. That would be the teachers and the parents, of course, and maybe grandparents. Then he got off onto what I would call family-friendly films, where he was doing younger children, critters like dogs, a lot of dogs, 101 Dalmatians, Beethoven, all dogs, and finally even a baby, Baby's Day Out. So the career kind of bifurcates itself right around the time she's having a baby, because that film, which was very autobiographical, failed. And I think John Hughes decided, okay, enough of the autobiography. I'm going to now do just plain straight comedy, like Dennis the Menace, like Miracle on 34th Street, a lot of remakes and things like that, 101 Dalmatians. So it really depends on which era you're talking about. The first era, I think, he connects with people because he first of all, he was a very good comedy writer. I mean, you mentioned Planes, Trains. I mean, you think of the amount of gags he put into that film, or the amount of gags he put into Home Alone. They're quite substantial, and they build upon themselves. There's a kind of a Rube Goldberg-like effect to all these gags, and it really works very well. And he wrote all those gags out. They were not kind of created on the scent with stunt people and other directors and actors. They were all written out and thought through in the rapid way he wrote. It was amazing he could come up with all these intricate gags. But I think that's one thing that might intrigue you. I think that when he was doing his teen films, which I understand didn't draw you in, your inner teen, but I think that he was talking directly to teenagers like he understood them. And I think that's what draws them in, at least.
His National Lampoon experience, you spent a lot of time in the book coming back and forth because Matty Sims, you bring him in, and PJ O'Rourke. I guess those are the films that I equate to, because I actually read the National Lampoon when it was coming out each month. Mm-hmm. I subscribed that's what I was doing as a teenager. Some of these kids were, you know, in the Breakfast Club, and I was reading National Lampoon and Playboy. I guess that's it. But it seemed like there are very different sections of his career. I mean, you talk about animal films, the teen films. I actually like She's Having a Baby. I mean, I only saw it once when it came out, but, you know, I kind of liked it. But like the, it doesn't. It seems odd that this guy who did the National Lampoon films was also the guy who did She's Having a Baby, was the guy who did Miracle on 34th Street. Does he have a current day equivalent among directors and writers?
I don't think he has any equivalent among writers or directors at any day, to be frank. I know that Kevin Smith and Judd Apatow talk about, they say they make, you know, John Hughes movies with a lot of F-bombs in them. But and of course, male nudity. But I don't quite see it the way they do. But, you know, in their minds, they think they're doing a kind of John Hughes-like film. So, I'll accept their word that they think they're doing that. I don't find that they're doing those kind of films. They're doing something great, but they're not doing that. So I don't find anybody who's doing his kind of films right now.
I would have said the closest might be. I would never have thought of Kevin Smith in that sentence, but Apatow may come closest. But it seems to me that he overshoots because he wants so much of that R-rated stuff and so much of that raunch that even a movie of his that could be somewhat sweeter, like This Is 40, to me it backfires because it's just so loaded with outrageous raunch, and any emotion that you would have found in a Hughes movie gets tossed aside in search of a nasty joke, basically.
I would agree with that. Yeah, but he does. He saw those films. Kevin Smith saw those films. A lot of people saw those films, and they're building on it in their own head, and that it's inspiring them. Let's say it inspires their work, even though it doesn't emulate that work at all. I don't find anybody doing those kinds of films. And in fact, I don't think you can do those kinds of films. Hollywood has no niche for it now. They don't make $20 million, be the equivalent of a $20 million movie. They don't make those anymore. They just don't. They make $50 million movies, or they make $100 million movies, or they might pick up a little independent film out of Sundance and put it through a classics division. But they don't have – John Hughes would have a hard time today creating the kind of film because he'd have to do it as an independent. There is no place at a studio, which is where he worked. He was always a studio guy. There was no place at a studio today that would make those kinds of films. He was making them in around the $12, $13, $14 million range. Home Alone cost around $17, which is fairly expensive for him at the time. He only had one really expensive movie, which is a complete fiasco, Baby's Day Out. So that niche is just gone out of the Hollywood subset. It just doesn't exist.
And yet, he was very good at creating what's the term I'm looking for? Tentpoles, or not tentpoles, but help me, Mr. Film Critic. You know, where you create one film and you can make three more after it.
Template?
Yeah, I mean.
Well, template. Well, the most obvious example of that was the Home Alone films. He made one Home Alone film, and they said, well, you know, if you have the most successful film in comedy history, someone's going to say, hey, how about a sequel? So he said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'm going to just do a remake. And he did. He just did a remake. The only thing what he did was send it to New York. He said everything in New York, but he has the wet bandits. He has the same gags. He had the timing of everything is that the whole family getting ready to go on an airplane. Everything is identical. The only difference is instead of going to Paris, they were going to Florida, and then he gets on the wrong plane at O'Hara and goes to JFK. So otherwise, it's the same movie, and he just did that over and over again. Then he took that template of the Wet Bandits, you know, the two goofy bad guys, and he used that over and over again. He used it in the Beethoven movie, he used it in 101 Dalmatians. You have the goofy, bumbling kidnappers in Baby's Day Out. He made it three goofy, bumbling kidnappers. He just added one. But yeah, he did in fact create these templates and maybe overuse them, you know, but the audiences didn't seem to mind.
I can't recall in the book, did you ever calculate how much his movies took in total?
Total? No, I didn't. It would probably, if you take out Home Alone, not be that significant compared to the kind of big box office they have today, because bear in mind, his comedies didn't travel overseas in the sense that most comedies do not travel. Comedies made in Europe don't come to the United States. Our comedies don't play well in very many places in the world. humor is a very weird national thing that just don't that just doesn't cross borders very often. We do sometimes like some British humor, and the British certainly liked John Hughes's humor. That was one place that did play, but except for Home Alone, where he hit it out of the ballpark. I mean, that played internationally. That made it the biggest international box office sensation, and for a comedy now, ever. But if you remove that from it, his films gross maybe, you know, maybe the height of 70-some million dollars, which would be Ferris Bueller, your favorite movie. Breakfast Club did around 50. It didn't do the kind of box office people think it did. John always said that they didn't put it out right, that they should have put it out in more of a platform release. In other words, a few cities the first week, then it expands a little bit to 30 cities maybe the next week and so on. It kind of played itself out in the South very quickly. It didn't stay there. Urban areas, it stayed for a few weeks. It did good business, 50 million, but it really found its audience in the video cassette and then later DVD.
Well, we have to be fair to Hughes, though. I mean, Breakfast Club, of course, is celebrating 30 years right now, which ties into your book. But $50 million in 1985 compared to today, that's got to be a $100 million movie easily.
It's a good gross. I mean, they were not unhappy with it. It's just the studio had thought maybe they could make a little more money on it. Certainly the producers did. But I think that Universal was the studio. I don't think they released it the way they probably should have. I think they could have gotten more money out of it. That's all I'm saying. Ferris Bueller, which was, you know, by all what most critics seem to feel was his most universally accepted film and enjoyed film, that kind of was the upper reaches for him until he came to Home Alone, and that was like in the $70 million range. But overall, I would say his grosses wouldn't impress you that much by today's standards, but they were certainly significant, and Hollywood made a lot of money off him.
And probably continues to with home video sales. I know DVDs are dying off, but Amazon, Netflix, all those things, I'm sure they're continuing to rake in a lot of good coin off of his work.
Well, you know, a little known fact is there's a lot of John Hughes scripts sitting around the studios gathering dust. I mean, he left a lot of scripts behind that are officially the product of, say, Paramount or Universal or what have you. I don't know if anybody wants to dust them off and try and update them a little bit. They could be made. I don't think they will, because I said this niche doesn't seem to exist anymore. And that price range of a film doesn't seem to exist anymore. And I'm not even sure they have that many talented young actors the way they did back in John's day. If you look at the actors in his day, it's really astonishing how many good actors there were. Many of them with still careers going on today. John Cryer, for instance, and Emilio Estes, Charlie Sheen, all these people Robert Downey Jr. It all began in John Hughes movies. People forget that. I think Robert Downey is billed as Robert Downey, not the Jr. back in those days. And when he did, what was it? Weird Science, I think it was. But it's really amazing the acting pool he could draw upon in the early 80s. And it wasn't just him. It was Francis Ford Coppola with The Outsider and Rumblefish. It was Martha Coolidge with Valley Girl. And there was a lot of people were doing youth movies in those days. And they had the young actors that could really support it.
So you don't think Shia LaBeouf could do it?
I mean, we could try.
Yeah.
He could maybe play Bender.
Yeah. I'm sure there's, you know, I'm sure you can always find actors to fit something that you're doing, whether or not they're going to be the right ones, whether they're going to be Anthony Michael Hall or Molly Ringwald. You know, there's a certain something there that he was able to latch onto and make, what, three movies each with each of them?
Yes, he was very good at casting, I will say that. You see it all through his career. Matthew Broderick, I don't know how he could have made that film without Matthew Broderick, Ferris Bueller we're talking about.
Right.
And then coming up with Jeffrey Jones, who at that point had played the Emperor in Amadeus and was known for his kind of improvisational comic skills, bringing him aboard. Jennifer Grey. I think that, you know, it's just brilliant in casting all the way through. And then discovering Macaulay Culkin and using him in two or three films the way he did. And Macaulay Culkin has not done well without John Hughes around in his life. So he did a very fine job of casting his films and protecting his talent and really nurturing his talent all the way through his career. You do see an occasional miscasting. I think The Great Outdoors, for some reason, John Candy, of course, is John Candy. He's wonderful. But Dan Aykroyd just doesn't work in that role. I can't figure out why, but it just... And even Howie Deutsch, who directed, said, I think I was the wrong guy for that film. I don't think I was good at that kind of broad comedy, which he wanted. I think I was miscast. But Dan Aykroyd doesn't work somehow in that film. But the film did very well. It didn't do badly.
Right. I agree with you about that. I mean, it seemed like Aykroyd was in that period where he was doing like everything that was thrown at him, Spies Like Us, and he did Great Outdoors, and there were other ones where Dr. Detroit, where he was just showing up. It seemed like he kept playing kind of a Dan Aykroyd playing a character, playing Dan Aykroyd, and it got really tiresome, I think, you know. And I think it's been good for all of us that he's kind of dropped out of sight and is just showing up occasionally again now.
Well, he's showing up in kind of like key roles in movies, or, you know, the guy who just comes in and does something, you know. I've actually been seeing him quite a bit lately. So, you know, I think it's interesting, all those Saturday Night Live guys who came around at the same time as National Lampoon was doing its shows, its radio shows and its plays and things like that. And they all kind of, those actors kind of intermingled in all those various venues. They've all kind of developed into interesting character actors, especially Bill Murray, who, if you compare him to, say, Chevy Chase never really learned how to act in a true sense, where I think Murray really has become a really fine actor. He was very good in St. Vincent, whatever you thought of the film last year. And, you know, he goes back again to the Harold Ramis, the great film Groundhog Day, and he has really evolved as an actor to a superb degree. There was a lot of actors from that day that John could draw upon that just did wonderful work in his film.
I like Murray, of course. I didn't see St. Vincent, but I was thinking of the movie where he has a very small part, I think, as Bill Murray in the zombie movie.
Which one was that?
Was it?
I didn't see that movie.
I can't remember the name, but he's really good. He just comes in briefly. You know, I guess L.A. has been decimated, and somehow they trip upon Bill Murray still wandering around his mansion, and he's playing Bill Murray, and it, you know, it's just it's great, and you know, of course, Lost in Transition. You're right. That is an amazing acting career.
Worthy of a biography, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Someone should do that. I wonder.
Someone should do that. No. Well, someone should really look and re-examine, because he came out of that sketch comedy, which a lot of the John Hughes early players did. But he really evolved into an actor. I mean, he really did. With Razor's Edge, he tried serious acting. I don't think that was very successful, but... As long as he's playing something like Lost in Translation that is, you know, it's funny, but there's also the serious underbelly to it, or Groundhog Day, he's wonderful. He's just wonderful.
Bill Murray is Hunter S. Thompson.
Yes, well, there you go.
Yeah. So tell me about choosing to do the book on John Hughes. Now, you talk about early in the book about how you interviewed him an awful lot, and was that kind of, I hate to say that it was low-hanging fruit for you, but you had all these interviews with him, you had all this direct contact. Was that what made this a good choice for you to do as a book?
Well, the interviews were actually always on the phone. He was in Chicago, and I was in L.A. reporting news for the Hollywood Reporter, and I was a hard news reporter, meaning if there was a deal he had just made for at a new studio or one of his projects went from one studio to the other, like The Bee. The Bee was a film that he tried to make, never could, but it went to three different studios. I'm on the phone to him to find out, you know, what's going on. And when John Candy passed on, I called him that day, and we had, I think our last conversation would have been then, which was 1994, I think. So I never actually met him, but I had interviewed him a lot more than I realized, because when I did the research and found all this material from the old Hollywood Reporters, that I realized I had talked to him many times. But no, it was my impetus was, here's a man who the critics reviewed his films, kind of dismissed them lightly, moved on to Woody Allen, which was much more serious comedy for them. Hollywood certainly loved making money off him, but they certainly weren't giving him accolades like the Academy Award nominations or anything like that. I wanted to look at this career and find out what it was that made him so successful and yet never was critically appraised with any kind of honesty about how well his films were doing with a certain segment of the population, rather important one, teenagers. And I felt the critics such as myself, because I was a critic, sandwiched in, but the reporting job was sandwiched between review critical work. I had done critical work at a place called the Daily News in Los Angeles, then the Hollywood Reporter. I eventually became their chief film critic, as you said in the introduction. But I had, in that intervening years, done some reporting, hard news reporting, where you're talking to all the executives in Hollywood, all the managers, all the agents, all the distribution people, the marketing people. You're trying to find out why films are working, why they're not, what's happening. A great, by the way, background for a critic, because then you understand the process. Most critics don't. They think they do, but they don't. I didn't understand until I had that job for several years. And I'm talking directly to people and say, why did you make this film? Why did this happen? Why is this not coming to fruition? It was really an interesting and an unbelievable education in the filmmaking process, which I think critics should understand. There's one, other people who say, no, a critic should just look at the film and judge it for it on its own merits, not have to know anything about how movies are made. I don't know. I'm of the other opinion. But I wanted to find out why John Hughes was so damn successful, because he was. And I wanted to understand what he did right and what it was about his comedy. And nobody's denying his comedy. What it was about his comedy that connected with people and still does today with his good films. He has some mediocre ones, but with his good films. We can disagree about Christmas Vacation.
But I'm just letting it slide.
Yes, I know. I appreciate that. I wanted to find out from a critic's point of view what it was and give it, reassess those films. And I think that's what I've done, reassess his films. With honesty, because I don't find some of his films. I mentioned The Great Outdoors. I don't think that one works. And that's even with his good friend John Candy. It just is the one film he made with Candy that didn't work, in my opinion. It did well at the box office. But I wanted to find out what made him tick. I wanted to find out how he was able to plug into this whole generation the way he did. And that's what I think the book attempts to do. I hope it does.
So what were some of the films that, in working on the book, you maybe changed your opinion of, either decided that they were not very good films or that they were underrated films?
I would say Uncle Buck, I think, is an underrated film. I think that's an extremely good film. John Candy gives one of his best performances because there's a serious edge to it. And remember, John Candy, at the time he passed on, was trying to find a way into more serious roles. JFK, which he made with Oliver Stone, it was a small part, but it certainly was no comedy role. And he was very good in that. And I think if he had – he wasn't being offered that many roles, but if he had found a way through his agent or manager or something to get those roles, I think he would have been a very successful actor of serious roles too. And I think Uncle Buck is as close as he comes in any film of John Hughes, where he is, you know, there's a serious undertone to that film, even though it's a very broad comedy, and obviously Macaulay Culkin is in it too, and they have these interesting scene where they're topping each other just one after another. Macaulay Culkin, at what, 8 years old or whatever, is holding his own with John Candy, a comedy legend. So that was the underappreciated one. I'm not in love with She's Having a Baby, but I think it was an interesting film and probably should have done better than it did. I see it wasn't what John Hughes fans were looking for, but it was a very interesting film. I think 16 Candles maybe is a better film than I thought it was when I was a young critic reviewing films and thinking, teenage film. There's a lot of things going on in there. I don't find the wedding situation towards the end to be very successful, but I do feel it really did talk to people about how kids feel about grandparents, parents being neglected in their own household. And it's a funny film. It's a very funny film. And I think Molly Ringwald is just wonderful in it. And I enjoyed rediscovering her in that film and in Breakfast Club. And she really is quite good. And I did Pretty in Pink would be another one. I think probably plays better than our memory says it does. That was a film where they had to reshoot a new ending. The ending that they tested was getting very negative feedback, especially from the young girls, because they didn't feel like Mallory Ringwald was ending up with the right guy. So they shot a new ending where she ends up with what they want, the one not with John Cryer. You know, they didn't want him to end up with John Cryer, the ducky. So they shot a new ending. But that film actually works pretty well. If you don't mind the ending, I think probably John's original ending was better. I'm not so sure he didn't think so, but because he tried to remake the film in a way and she in some kind of wonderful, a film that didn't work. But he was trying to remake Pretty in Pink and make it come out right this time so that the two kids from the wrong side of the track get together. But that was a film where he decided to fire his director 4 days before they were starting to shoot. So that was almost a doomed project to begin with.
I don't imagine John Cryer would have had this Two and a Half Men career if he had gotten the girl in that one movie.
Never thought about that. Is that true?
Well, think about it. I mean, you know, you could believe him, I think, in Two and a Half Men because you remember, if you remember him as Ducky at all, he was the loser. He didn't get the girl. Yeah, he just spent the last, 12, 13 years not getting the girl and getting about $1 million a week for his trouble.
Well, that's a good point. So I certainly think John Cryer I know John Cryer owes a great debt to John Hughes, and he certainly was very happy to talk to me about it. It was very hard to fit me into his schedule because it's a hellishly difficult schedule, but he was able to find time on his lunch break or something, and he was really happy about getting work in that film because he, like you, was a National Lampoon guy. And he remembered reading John Hughes' stories in the National Lampoon, and he was surprised, John, by saying, you know, I really like working with you in a lot because I really like the fact you were the National Lampoon, you know. And so John suddenly found a soulmate who had actually read him in the National Lampoon, and they would talk about the various stories John had written there, one of which was Vacation 58, which, of course, became the basis for National Lampoon's Vacation. So, yeah, John Cryer certainly, I hadn't thought about it, but certainly may owe his entire career to John Hughes.
Yeah, who knows who Charlie Sheen would have done those first 9 years with if that happened. You know, one of the things that's kind of subtle in the book is the sheer number of actors and folks that you talk to about John Hughes, and you have a lot of material from them. And maybe because of that, one of the things I really was interested in, and again, the Ferris Bueller stuff, I'm always interested to learn more about that movie. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize, I guess I never thought about it, the age difference between Mia Sara, Matthew Broderick, and, oh my gosh, I can't remember the fellow's name who played Cameron all of a sudden. He was later in Spin City and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I'll think of it in a minute. But yeah.
I mean, she was, I guess Mia Sara was 18, maybe 19 tops. Matthew Broderick was 23. And the guy who played Cameron was like 29.
Yeah.
And that guy and Broderick were friends beforehand. They had been in, I think you say, Biloxi Blues.
They had done Broadway together with Gene Sachs was the director, Neil Simon.
Simon, right.
And so Matthew Broderick, I believe, actually recommended him to John and John Ruck, I think. And because he knew, well, they played with each other on Broadway. So there was already, and they became friends. So there was already this kind of camaraderie that would translate well as being best buds in Ferris Bueller. So certainly, and the age disparity is always in teen movies. That's always a problem you have because the child labor laws are such you can't really work with very young actors. So you always have to have slightly older actors. And so you almost always have 20-year-olds playing guys or women in high school. Even John does that a little bit because the three of the five actors in Breakfast Club are past 20. But two were genuine teenagers, and they could play it. you know, Judd Nelson at 25, I think, was the oldest, but they could play 18 convincingly. And John, again, back to casting, he was always good at getting the right cast. But Ferris Bueller is certainly his best cast in terms of, as I said, I don't know how you would pull that off without Matthew Broderick and Jeffrey Jones. They're so good. And even Jennifer Grey is really quite wonderful. You know, she and Matthew Broderick hooked up and were going to got engaged briefly after that film. There was a real ensemble nature to that piece. It isn't just Matthew Broderick and Ferris Bueller. It's the trio. And then there's the sets of parents. And then there's the principal and his assistant. And there are these little, how you say it, little like areas where the ensemble cast would come in. This the high school, and then the principal's office, and then Chicago Cubs, you know, stadium, Wrigley Field. All these things set up little ensembles going on throughout the picture, and it isn't just one guy dominating the film. Even though you think about Matthew Broderick, he really is well supported by the actors.
Well, it's also it's what you were saying reminded me of this. Matthew Broderick, of course, was pretty serious with his on-screen sister Jennifer Grey for a period of time. You also point out in the book, I think, that the actors who played his parents wound up marrying after the
film. Yes, they did, actually. Right? Yeah.
Cindy Pickett and can't remember the fellow's name.
We're having trouble with male names here, aren't we?
Yeah, I don't know what that's about. But also, I was thinking as you were saying that. So if John Cryer owes his career on Two and a Half Men to John Hughes, well, Charlie Sheen owes his career in Two and a Half Men to John Hughes for Ferris Bueller, right? I mean, he was basically playing the younger version of
himself.
Yeah, I mean, right?
So Two and a Half Men all goes back to Ferris Bueller. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's what I'm saying, yeah. I mean, if Edie McClug had wound up as either the housekeeper or the boy's mother on that show, case closed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Charlie Sheen's part was actually cut slightly. There was apparently more about his family, and he was somehow – there's a tow truck operator in that who tows away the principal's car. I think that was his family's business, was the tow truck operator. So there was a longer part of that, but John did cut the film. I don't think you miss it. I think Charlie showing up in just that one scene, which is a police station, is actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
And I don't think you need any more introduction to him. I'd love to see this other version, because what Matthew Broderick told me was that it had more serious elements, more Breakfast Club elements, if you will, about, you know, what do you do after high school, and what if you peak too early, and you know, angst about the future, and these sort of things that were eliminated in the editing room when John tested it with audiences and tested it with himself. And he cut it for a straight comedy. Whereas when he originally wrote it, there were other elements in there that just came out after they shot it. So, and they were very concerned about how audience would react to Ferris, because if you think about it, he's kind of an entitled person.
Yeah, a little bit.
And that could play very badly if you don't have some of the genius of Matthew Broderick playing that role. And I think John didn't pursue a lot of actors in his career, but he did pursue Matthew Broderick for this film, and he did pursue Steve Martin for Planes. So I think he knew when he had a role that needed just the right kind of actor, because if you think about Steve Martin's role in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, that could be a very annoying character too, because he's almost a misanthrope. He's thoroughly trashing, thoroughly dissing the John Candy character throughout the movie. And you need a certain kind of actor that can get away with that and still not lose audience empathy. And Steve Martin is exactly that kind of actor.
You also point out, and this is the last thing I'll say about Ferris, and we'll start wrapping up in a second, but you also point out, I think, that also cut out of that movie was that there was at least one other sister, maybe two, who were completely cut out of the movie. Is that right?
I was told there were other sisters. I don't know how they would work, because it seems just perfect. I mean, it's not, they don't make a reference to anybody else.
Right.
So, yeah, they John would sometimes, even in 16 Candles, there's a sister that gets introduced in the movie, and she disappears from the movie. She's in the background in a few shots, but she has a couple of good lines in the beginning, and then, boop, gone. So
kind of like the older brother from the first season of Happy Days.
Yeah, I think there's a he would write so many characters for his families, because he always had a lot of siblings, that sometimes even in the editing, it just there wasn't enough room in 16 Candles, or there wasn't enough room in Ferris, so they just cut it down. And in fact, in Vacation 58, in the original story in National Lampoon, there were other children in the car. He just reduced it to two for the movie, and it makes perfect sense. Anymore, and it'd be with Grandma on top, and you know, that'd be way too many people.
I'm sorry, you're going to get me laughing. Okay, so the last thing I want to ask you
about. I don't want you to be laughing, and we're talking about comedy here, and that's serious. No laughing.
Those vacation movies, those two vacation movies, they kill me. You need to go back. Anyway. Okay. Last thing I want to ask you
about. In fact, no.
All right. There's been this effort of late. This week, as a matter of fact, I think in particular, to rewrite kind of the history of Steve Jobs. There was the book 2 or 3 years ago about Jobs that kind of painted him as kind of a strange character with a lot of mental issues, mental health issues. And now this new book has come out, and hopefully this will, I'll circle around. A new book has come out that the family's gotten behind, and they're endorsing, and even Apple Computer, even though it's not authorized, is saying, yeah, this is the book if you want to know about Steve. And I read an excerpt from it last night, and they're talking about how, you know, he couldn't have possibly been the horrible person that he was painted as, because look what he accomplished and the people with him. And yet all the stories that are in this excerpt are they all start with, well, yeah, a lot of people hated him or everybody fought with him. But – and so in your book on Hughes, you tiptoe a little bit around the fact that there were some issues with his personality as well. I mean, he cut Molly Ringwald out. After the third movie they did, I don't think she ever spoke to him again.
Anthony Michael Hall was also not. He didn't speak to either of them in the last 20 years of his life. He had, I guess, no need to, in the sense they weren't going to be working together, and he had pretty much retired in the last 10 years of his life. But no, it's true. There wasn't any communication between them. I don't know if I tiptoed around this though. I think I pretty much lay out the fact that John Hughes was very good at blowing up relationships with people. I think in some case it may have been deserved. There were people at the studio level, you know, that fought him on various creative decisions. And when you consider his track record, why would you say no to John Hughes? As Warner Brothers did when he wanted to spend $1 million more on Home Alone. And he says, no, I won't. I'll do it at this price. And the studio said, well, no, you're going to have to take it someplace else. So I understand why John Hughes was furious at a lot of people. But there was a lot of people he would get, you know, pout over that don't even know what they did. You know, they can't even imagine it because they would be usually people running his company or in his company. A friend of mine was a publicist for him, and a studio print didn't arrive at USC for a screening when it should have. It was the Universal's fault. It wasn't her fault, but somehow, or I don't know if it was Universal, it was a studio anyway. Somehow it became her fault in his head, and he just wouldn't speak to her again. And you can't very well be a publicist for a man who won't speak to you, so she just had to resign her job. And this would happen over and over and over again. Torquin Gotch, who was a British R&R guy.
I was just going to ask you about him, yeah.
Yeah, he came aboard to do a lot of the soundtrack albums for John, and then John started using him as an executive producer, and pretty soon he found himself on the outs. He doesn't know why. John wouldn't speak to him. So he said he went back to England. He was an A&R guy, and so he started, you know, working with bands there again. And John one day, like a year of not speaking to him, calls him up and said, I'd like you to come and run my company. John, you haven't even been speaking to me for ages. Why? And he said, I'll pay you a lot of money. So, you know, he did say, though, you'll have to quit doing the jobs in England. You have to be full-time. You have to live in Chicago, which was not an easy thing to do because the weather there is, I'm told, not very good.
I hear that.
Yeah, but in any event, Torquin decided to take him up on it, and he did work for him for several more years. So he went through that freeze-out, and then he was back in the sunshine again. And Torquin does talk about it in terms of being in Siberia and being in Palm Springs. It's kind of the two dichotomies. And this happened over and over again. Christopher Columbus made two successful films with him, the Home Alone films, but he wanted to go live in San Francisco and not stay in Chicago. He wanted to make movies like Mrs. Doubtfire, and so John just didn't talk to him anymore. And over again, John would get very upset if actors didn't want to do his films, if people wanted to do other films, if Molly Ringwald wanted to do another film that wasn't a John Hughes film. And that he seemed to have a very strange definition of loyalty, especially in a town where an actor has to constantly work to make money. You have to constantly do different kinds of roles to broaden your range, to improve your quote, that is to say, your price. You have an agent telling you you need to do this. You can't simply do John Hughes movies, because as prolific as he was, it was still maybe only a couple of movies a year, and a good actor could maybe in those days do two or three movies in a year, or maybe do a TV show or something else. It was always John calling up his agent saying he wants no more of this person, his agent waiting a day or two to let things calm down and try and patch things over. The agent, in this case being Jack Rabke, who himself was fired many times by John, only to be brought back a few months later. And until the last time John did it, he said, "That's it, John, I'm not going to be in your life anymore." And he wasn't. He said, I called him to congratulate him on the marriage of his son, John Hughes' son. And then John started to talk business. He says, "John, we're not talking business. I just called to congratulate your son's wedding. That's it. Goodbye." He says, "You know, it's not," and he told me, "you know, it's not like other people don't have feelings too. John always had his hurt feelings, but other people have hurt feelings. But as you were saying, he must be doing something right, because he certainly worked with a lot of great people. He knew how to bring great people into his projects, and he had a very, very good track record in Hollywood, especially in a very tricky field, which is comedy."
Well, Kirk, it was a really fun book to read, and it's been fascinating to talk to you in more detail about it. And folks, listen, you can order Kirk Honeycutt's new filmography, John Hughes, A Life in Film, from great retailers everywhere, or you can get it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching us on MRMedia.com, the main site, somewhere to the left or the right below my guest, you will see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. You can is the book available as an ebook? I'm sorry, I didn't check that first.
No, it will be, but not yet. It's not available as Kindle.
Oh, okay.
It's not available as Kindle, but I do believe there might be soon some kind of Amazon platform it's available on. Because someone did it send me on Twitter a question like that, because I didn't know either. But it's a picture book, and so there's a lot of photographs and things that I don't know how that would translate in an ebook, but they certainly really found some great, the publisher found some really great photos of John, and there's a great section where you look at all the costumes from Breakfast Club. Marilyn Vance was the costume designer, and she provided all the boards she did for the various characters, and it's really quite interesting, because, you know, those costumes really spoke to who those characters were.
Oh, there's a lot of great stuff in the book. I mean, I really recommend it for anyone who's interested. And even in a handful of John Hughes movies, you're going to learn a lot about the films and behind the scenes about the films. And many of the actors have spoken to Kirk for the book. It's really good stuff. And then also check out his website, which is honeycutshollywood.com. It's all solid. Honeycutt is two T's.
Two T's.
Honeycutshollywood.com. Can people find you on social media at all, Twitter or Facebook? Are you doing any of that stuff?
Oh, yes. You have to these days. Yes.
That's what I hear. All right. Well, Kirk, it was a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you for joining us on the show, and we'll look forward to whatever comes next.
Thank you.
Turn up the stereo receiver. Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank news and comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Melser crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.